This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, for the first time in more than 100 years, bull elk are returning to areas of southern Wisconsin. At least a couple of them have. We'll find out why they're showing up and the ongoing effort to reestablish their presence in the state. Now, for the past 5 weeks, the WPR Reports podcast Mapped Out has taken a close look at Wisconsin's current electoral maps, how they were drawn in 2011, the advantage they gave Republicans in the legislature, and the impact they've had on policy. But currently, the clock is ticking for the state to settle in on new political boundaries. The People's Maps Commission, put together by Governor Evers, proposed new maps last month. More recently, Republican lawmakers released their own maps, which are likely to be vetoed by the governor. So what happens next? That's the subject of this week's episode of Mapped Out. Sean Johnson and Bridget Bowden look at how the issue could play out in the courts and what that means for the next decade of elections.
So, Bridget, we've reached episode 6, and we've been through a lot.
Yep. We went to school to learn about redistricting. We learned about the last time redistricting happened in Wisconsin, what that meant for the state, and the legal challenges.
But the story doesn't end there, right?
That's right, because redistricting is happening again, right now.
So, I guess we should talk about what's going to happen this time.
Yeah, so it's pretty simple. The legislature has a constitutional duty to redistrict. Republicans run the legislature, so they'll pass a map. End of story.
Not so fast, because remember, our governor, Tony Evers, is a Democrat. And I can tell you from my keen journalistic observational powers that he's going to veto that map. And by the way, the governor has his own maps that were drawn up by a commission he established.
Okay, and let me draw from my keen journalistic observational powers and offer you this. The legislature's not going to pass his maps.
Sounds like an impasse. And what do we do when we have an impasse in redistricting? We go to court.
Specifically, we go to federal court, which has a long history of handling redistricting.
Hold on. I beg to differ. This is a state matter, and they have courts here, including the state Supreme Court, which will obviously be the one to resolve this case.
Well, I heard that the state Supreme Court doesn't even want to take up redistricting because it's complicated. Like, one of the justices even said they don't have the staff for it.
Yeah, well, I heard there's a bill that would just turn over the whole thing to a nonpartisan redistricting commission, like Iowa.
Okay, but aren't we really ignoring the elephant in the room here? Two words, joint resolution. You can't veto those.
Okay, so when you put it that way, it sounds like a lot, but there really are a lot of ways redistricting could go this time.
And in this episode, we're going to talk you through them.
From WPR Reports, I'm Sean Johnson.
And I'm Bridget Bowden. This is Mapped Out.
Okay, theoretically, there are a few different ways this could go. First, nonpartisan redistricting.
Taking the process out of the legislature's hands and handing it to a nonpartisan agency. Remember this from the last episode? It's popular in Wisconsin, supported by 70% of the voting public across the partisan divide.
There have also been referenda all over the state in support of nonpartisan redistricting. And these are non-binding, but they give you an idea of where people are at.
There's a bill that would set up a system where the legislature's nonpartisan attorneys would draw the maps. Lawmakers would then have the chance to vote them up or down. When it was introduced this year, supporters held a rally outside the Capitol.
This bill is not about any party. It's about establishing a process that gets politicians out of the map-making business altogether.
So let's pass this bill to bring fair maps to the people and bring common sense back to Wisconsin and public service. Thank you.
That was State Representative Deb Andraka and State Senator Jeff Smith. And while they are pushing a nonpartisan redistricting system, they're both Democrats.
And so are most of the speakers at this rally. The bill does have two Republican co-authors, but in Wisconsin, practically speaking, it's mostly Democrats who want to change the way we draw maps.
But if you lived somewhere else, you might be hearing a lot of the same arguments, only from Republicans. Listen to this press conference from Illinois Republicans about redistricting.
Politicians should not draw their own maps. Politicians shouldn't pick their own voters. And the people know that if any one party rejects an independent map-making process, they do so solely to fulfill a political and partisan purpose.
That's Jason Barrickman. He's a state senator from Bloomington, Illinois. And we know we mentioned this, but it bears repeating. He's a Republican.
In Illinois, Democrats hold all the power, so they get to draw the maps. It's kind of the opposite of what happened in Wisconsin in 2011. So some of the stuff you hear Illinois Republicans say sounds a lot like what you hear from Wisconsin Democrats.
And there's another Republican who wanted redistricting reform. Someone you've definitely heard of.
The fact is, gerrymandering has become a national scandal.
So two things. Yeah, that's Ronald Reagan calling for redistricting reform. And yes, he calls gerrymandering gerrymandering. And he knows what he's doing here. Remember episode one? Gerrymandering is named after Elbridge Gerry. Reagan stands by the hard G.
But the point here is, that's Ronald Reagan, Republican legend.
He gave that speech at a meeting of the Republican Governors Association in 1987, toward the end of his second term as president. He's frustrated that despite his strong popularity, he's never had a Congress that was fully controlled by Republicans.
Fair deal, and that's all we're asking for. An end to the anti-democratic and un-American practice of gerrymandering congressional districts.
And Reagan talked about this repeatedly. What's our point here? Redistricting reform is not strictly a Democratic or Republican issue. It depends on political circumstances.
And the circumstances in Wisconsin are this. Democratic lawmakers want redistricting reform, but they're basically powerless to make it happen because they'd need Republicans to change the system. And Republicans in Wisconsin say they won't do it.
Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss put out a written statement the day of that Wisconsin rally saying he would not support a nonpartisan redistricting plan. Voss said, quote, "The Wisconsin Constitution requires the state legislature to enact a redistricting plan. It would be unconstitutional to turn this duty over to a group of unelected bureaucrats."
So a nonpartisan commission? That's not likely to happen in Wisconsin anytime soon. That said, the governor, Tony Evers, wanted to try something like this.
In the coming days, I will be signing an executive order to create a nonpartisan redistricting commission who will draw the people's maps.
The governor's People's Maps Commission is a little different than the system advocates at that rally were proposing. Instead of relying on civil servants, Evers picked a panel of retired judges to pick a panel of 9 citizens to take input from the public and draw maps.
And the final product? It's still skewed Republican. Moon Duchin, a redistricting expert and math professor from Tufts University, worked with the commission.
And this is due to the well-known fact that if you draw districts against the real political geography of most any American state, there's districts tend to confer a geographic advantage to Republicans who at this time in U.S. history are more spread out across rural areas while Democrats are a bit more concentrated.
So when Duchin refers to political geography, think about what that means in Wisconsin. Our cities, Milwaukee, Madison, Green Bay, etc., are full of Democratic voters. And they're even more Democratic than they used to be a couple decades ago. We've talked about packing and redistricting. Some of it happens naturally.
That leaves fewer Democrats in small towns and rural areas than there used to be. So even a neutral redistricting plan can still favor one party.
The whole idea of this commission was to produce a final map and ask the legislature to vote on it. But Republicans in the legislature, like Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, say they won't pass this map.
He can form whatever kind of fake, phony, partisan process he wants to create, but I have no doubt in the end we will do it the way we always have, which is to follow the Constitution.
So again, we're not saying this can't happen or that the People's Maps Commission won't influence redistricting this time around.
But it faces long odds. The legislature has other plans.
More on that after the break.
We're listening to the new episode of the WPR podcast Mapped Out, this week dueling proposals for Wisconsin's new political maps and how the issue could eventually be settled in court. We'll hear more coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're listening to the latest episode of the WPR Reports podcast, Mapped Out. Sean Johnson and Bridget Bowden are looking at where the state's redistricting process goes next. The Independent People's Maps Commission put out its proposals for what it says would be fair electoral maps for the state, but the maps are just that, proposals. The first official step in redistricting is in the hands of Republican lawmakers who drew Wisconsin's current maps 10 years ago.
We've been talking about the Wisconsin State Legislature for 5 episodes, how they were able to draw the maps in 2011 and cement their majority for a decade.
The state constitution says after the census, the legislature shall apportion and district anew the members of the Senate and Assembly according to the number of inhabitants.
Just like the last time, Republicans have hired private attorneys to help with redistricting. But they also took a page from the governor's People's Maps Commission. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss set up his own public redistricting portal where people can submit maps online.
But the submissions are not just from random people. A few came from Joe Handrick. Remember him? He's been involved in redistricting for decades and was one of the Republicans working in the map room in 2011.
The legislature unveiled its maps on October 20th. And just like a decade ago, they are far more Republican than the state as a whole. A review by the Campaign Legal Center found they'd make it virtually impossible for Democrats to win a majority.
Republicans are going to pass their map, and then it will go to Governor Tony Evers' desk. And what might the governor do?
So I want to be clear today. If the Republican maps come to my desk as they're currently drafted, I'll veto them. It's just as simple as that.
So to review, nonpartisan redistricting in Wisconsin. Could happen, but probably not going to happen.
The People's Maps Commission map. Again, could happen, but likely not.
The legislature and governor agreeing on a map? Again, technically possible, but probably not going to happen.
So what is going to happen?
Well, this map will probably be decided by a court. Which court? Yablon says it could go a couple different ways.
You know, litigators on both sides are going to try to find the court where they think they're most likely to achieve their goals.
There are really two options, federal court or the state Supreme Court. Let's start with federal court.
We know that's where Democrats want to resolve redistricting because they filed a lawsuit there just one day after the new U.S. Census data was released. 10 days later, several citizen groups that align with Democrats filed their own lawsuit in that same court.
Why might Democrats prefer federal court?
I think that for the Democrats, or really anyone who wants to undo the gerrymander that we have in Wisconsin, they probably thought that they would have a better shot in federal court, given the track record of the federal courts with Wisconsin redistricting in the past.
Federal courts had a hand in drawing Wisconsin's maps in the 2000s, the 1990s, and the 1980s. They handle redistricting a lot.
But first, this federal court is going to give a state court a chance to resolve redistricting, specifically the Wisconsin Supreme Court.
And that is where a conservative group, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, has chosen to file its lawsuit, and GOP lawmakers have joined them.
So, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, where do we begin? There is a lot to say.
So first of all, it has 7 members. They serve 10-year terms.
And while redistricting is definitely within their purview, they typically have not been the ones to do it here. The last time they drew a map for Wisconsin was 1964.
Earlier this year, there was a hearing for a plan that would force the Wisconsin Supreme Court to handle redistricting. About 4 minutes after it starts, Chief Justice Patience Rogensack cuts in. She doesn't see how the state Supreme Court could handle map drawing.
Drawing maps would take a huge staff. We don't have them. And since we work for the state, we can't just go hire somebody. You have to have position authority before you can do that. I don't know how in the world you think the court could ever draw the maps.
But those hesitations aside, Rob Yablon says the state Supreme Court could still end up resolving redistricting if justices do it another way.
It's possible that the state Supreme Court will be more inclined to just choose one of the maps that's submitted to it, which requires a little bit less technical expertise on its part.
Something else you need to know about the Wisconsin Supreme Court. It's an elected court, and it's officially nonpartisan. Officially. But in practice, these races get very partisan. so partisan that these days the Democratic and Republican parties both actively campaign for the candidates they want.
The state Supreme Court has had a conservative majority for a while now, since 2008.
And in many instances, that court has sided with the position that's preferred by the Republicans in the legislature.
In the last decade, the court upheld major laws passed during Scott Walker's administration. Act 10, the law that took away union rights, voter ID, the lame duck laws.
The court currently has a 4-3 conservative majority. But for the last couple years, on some very big issues, that majority has not been a given.
That's really because of one justice, Brian Hagedorn.
Hagedorn was elected in 2019, and like many statewide elections in Wisconsin, it was close. He won by less than 6,000 votes statewide.
A lot of people didn't think he was going to win that year. And when he did, he made a point to thank the people who got him there. Here he is at the 2019 Republican State Convention.
Thank you. Thank you. When I got punched, you were the ones who punched back. When I got knocked down, you grabbed the baton and you kept running with it. You did. You did this.
But Hagedorn tells Republicans something else that day. And with the benefit of hindsight, it seems significant. Hagedorn says he's not going to play politics on the court. He'll defend the rule of law.
And it might mean, by the way, that sometimes I issue rulings over the next 10 years that some of you won't like. But I just want you to know that when that happens, it's because I'm being faithful to the oath that I'm going to take, and I'm doing exactly what I said I was going to do.
And Hagedorn has indeed gone against Republicans. He ruled against them when they challenged the Evers administration's stay-at-home order. And he ruled against President Donald Trump and his allies three times in lawsuits seeking to overturn Wisconsin's 2020 election results.
So, Rob Yablon says Brian Hagedorn is definitely the justice everyone is watching if the Wisconsin Supreme Court decides to handle redistricting. And Yablon thinks there's a fair chance Hagedorn might not side with Republicans.
I think that he might think that that courts are meant to be neutral arbiters. And it's hard to really cast yourself as a neutral arbiter if you're choosing a redistricting plan that is very clearly one that has a partisan tilt to it.
But one more thing about Justice Brian Hagedorn. About a decade ago, the last time Wisconsin's district maps were drawn, Hagedorn had a very different job. He wasn't a justice. He wasn't a judge. He was chief legal counsel for Republican Governor Scott Walker.
In other words, he was Walker's lawyer when Walker signed the map.
Okay, before we wrap up this list of what-ifs, we want to talk about two other things that could happen.
And at this moment in time, these might seem more far-fetched than the other options, but they're worth talking about.
One of those options would be a massive shakeup to the way redistricting has historically happened in Wisconsin. Republicans could try to bypass the governor altogether and pass redistricting as a joint resolution, which does not require his signature.
The legislature actually tried this in 1963, but a unanimous Wisconsin Supreme Court struck them down. They said redistricting is something the legislature and governor have to do together.
Republican leaders were asked about this in 2019, and they said they'd never even discussed it. But they also never promised they wouldn't try.
Before we wrap up, there is one more hypothetical that seems worth mentioning. And it depends on what happens in the 2022 election.
Let's say the redistricting process happens like we expect. A court draws the maps, and it seems like everything is done.
And let's say that in the 2022 elections, Republicans keep their majorities in the legislature, and they defeat Democratic Governor Tony Evers.
They take office in 2023, and just like during the Walker years, they have single-party control of state government. Could they pass another new map?
I do think that they could redo a court-drawn map if they chose to.
And we checked with the Legislative Reference Bureau about this, the legislature's nonpartisan attorneys. And they said, yes, a future legislature and governor could redraw the maps this decade. In fact, they could redraw the lines as many times as they want to.
Elections, they matter. Because whoever wins could guide this unseen force and harness the power of redistricting for years to come. Wait, one more thing. Remember, redistricting is happening right now.
We'll be keeping an eye on it. And when stuff happens, we'll be here with updates. So stay tuned. Mapped Out is reported by Bridget Bowden.
And Sean Johnson. We're produced by Brad Kohlberg, edited by Noah Ovshinsky. Music by Carl Christensen. Additional support from Adam Friedrich.
Digital editing by John K. Wilson and digital direction by David Hyland.
Photography by Angela Major. Artwork by John Nichols.
You can see more at wpr.org/mappedout.
You can hear all the episodes of Mapped Out online. You can also find recent conversations about redistricting from Central Time and The Morning Show at the WPR.org program archives. We'll be following the next steps in the process and talking about developments as they happen. Keep an ear out for those discussions over the air, streaming online, or on the WPR smartphone app. And of course, you can share your thoughts with us anytime. Email ideas@WPR.org. Or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. What are you hoping comes out of redistricting? Should Wisconsin change its process, or do you like the way things work now? Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, down on the farm can mean the big city. Find out about an urban farming project in Milwaukee, how it works, if it could be a model for others. That's tomorrow morning here on the Ideas Network. Some new research on the relationship between pet dogs and their humans. You know that things dogs do sometimes where they tilt their head sideways, kind of quizzical-like, like they're saying, "Murr?" As reported in Smithsonian Magazine, that may be a sign that those dogs are really smart. Researchers in Budapest tested dogs on their ability to understand the names of different toys. Like, you tell the dog, go get the squeaky, and it brings back the squeaky instead of a shoe or something. Some dogs in the study could only lock in on two toy names. The smartest ones, mostly border collies, could remember 10 or more. Those smart dogs, they were way more likely to tilt their heads when the human was asking for the toy. So researchers figure that sideways head tilt may be a sign that the dog is activating its memory powers. I do that a lot during the show when I'm listening to a guest or to you. That means I'm at least as smart as a border collie, I think. Murr? This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we explain some of the biggest policy pledges to come out of this week's global climate conference. Now, people in southern Wisconsin are seeing something they haven't seen in a long, long time, at least a few people. Bull elk used to be widespread across North America, but were eventually eliminated from Wisconsin in the 1880s. Fast forward to a few years ago, an effort began to reestablish elk in the state. Now they're spreading out a little bit. Scott Repke is an area wildlife supervisor with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. He's based in Black River Falls. Scott, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Where are we most likely to see an elk here in Wisconsin?
Wisconsin has two herds currently. One is in central Wisconsin in Jackson County. That's our newer herd. And then our second herd, which originated in 1995, is up near the town of Clam Lake in Sawyer, Ashland, and Bayfield County.
I'll talk to you about the reestablishment effort in a bit, but we've had a couple reports. The DNR says elk being seen in southern Wisconsin, probably young ones. What's going on there?
Yeah, we have had a few sightings in southern Wisconsin this year, and that's a trend we've seen over the past 2 to 3 falls. Mostly these are younger male elk called bulls. We are at the tail end of the breeding season called the rut for elk, which occurs in September and October. And what we believe is occurring is these younger males who don't have any breeding rights within the existing herds, they kind of set off on their own in search of female elk specifically. And Because they don't find female elk in our adjacent counties, they end up continuing to wander until they eventually either end up back here or end up in some other area of the state.
I know the DNR has a really important message with deer season coming up. For hunters in southern Wisconsin in particular who may never have seen an elk in the wild, you're looking for them to be really careful, right?
Yeah, exactly. Elk are not legal for harvest, although we do have a hunting season in our Clam Lake Elk Range currently. Unless you have a legal elk harvest permit, you cannot shoot an elk. So we are asking hunters to keep an eye out. Elk are quite a bit larger than deer. They have a different coloration. A lot of elk wear either a radio tracking collar or ear tags, and they live in large groups. So there are quite a few distinctions between elk and deer. And the biggest thing as a hunter is you need to be aware of your target and what's beyond. So all hunters should be on the lookout for elk. Doesn't matter if you're within the existing elk ranges or anywhere else in the state at this point.
And police in Wisconsin Rapids last month were on the lookout. They gave an elk a police escort so nobody would crash into it. It was going through the city of Wisconsin Rapids. I see deer in cities from time to time. Elk, that's pretty rare here in Wisconsin to see them, see the urban elk.
Yeah, for sure. You know, they typically don't spend time in urban areas, but it's also not unheard of. You know, no different than other wildlife such as deer, bear moving through the cities. So, yeah, hopefully he made it out of the city without any other issues.
We're talking to Scott Repke from the state DNR about elk in the state and the reintroduction efforts. And Scott, can you talk us through the reintroduction of elk in Wisconsin? What's that process been like?
Yeah, it's been a very rewarding process. Our initial reintroduction was in 1995, again, near the town of Clam Lake. That was initiated by the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. That herd is growing well. It's up to about 330 animals as of this summer. Our second reintroduction effort got started in 2015. The state of Wisconsin partnered with the state of Kentucky and acquired some additional elk to not only start a new herd in Jackson County in the Central Forest, but also to supplement additional elk up into that Clam Lake Elk Range. So that reintroduction process went extremely well. We brought in 141 elk from the state of Kentucky, and now we have two well-established elk herds that are growing in Wisconsin.
As I mentioned, elk had disappeared from Wisconsin more than well over a century ago. What led to that?
It was really due to two reasons. Unregulated harvest was a primary reason. Elk are an easy target for hunters. And as European settlers moved into the state of Wisconsin and increased in numbers, they targeted elk primarily for food. And also due to the loss of habitat at the time when our native habitat, our grasslands, oak savannas, and forests were converted to farmland.
What's the state's long-term goal for the elk populations?
We have a goal currently for each elk range. Our goal for the Clam Lake Elk Range is 1,400 elk. And the goal for the Black River Elk Range in central Wisconsin is 390 elk.
And are you looking for Wisconsinites to report elk sightings? Does that help you keep track of where they are?
Yes, it absolutely does. We certainly appreciate any and all reports from citizens. They can do that a couple different ways. They can go onto the DNR's website and search Large Mammal Observation Form. They can open up that form, type in a little bit of information, and submit it to us. They can email us or give us a phone call. Our contact information can be found on the DNR's website. Or if you're familiar with your local DNR staff, you can certainly reach out to them, and they will forward on that information to myself.
Scott, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Scott Repke is an area wildlife supervisor for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. We talked to him about the return of bull elk in a couple of cases to southern Wisconsin and ongoing efforts to reestablish their presence in the state. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about embracing the outdoors.
During times of stress and uncertainty, we look for sources of comfort and connection. During the pandemic, that came in the form of two inflatable kayaks for Micey Vang of Sun Prairie and her family. Here she is with a story about paddling her way through the pandemic.
When the impact of COVID isolation really sank in, how did you pass your time? Did you bake your own bread pretend the floor was lava, grow your own vegetables, or adopt a pet? I confess, I did partake in some, okay, admittedly all, of these ventures. What my family and I also did was rediscover the natural beauty Wisconsin has to offer. We have always committed to filling our days with adventure and had a hard time staying put indoors. But having the world closed down truly opened our eyes to appreciate the beauty Wisconsin offers outdoors, sometimes within a few minutes' drive from home or a few minutes' drive from the state's borders. To discover beyond what we could from a drive or even on foot, my family and I took to the waters. My husband and I got our hands on a pair of inflatable kayaks. We would keep the rolled-up kayaks in the car, stop by any suitable body of water, inflate them, plop our girls in with us, and go for a nice, quiet paddle. This immediately transformed the hustle and bustle of land life into a quiet, peaceful experience on the water. Wisconsin waterways are special. Just about all navigable waters allow for public access, which is different from some of our neighboring states. Wisconsin is home to over 12,600 rivers and streams, creating more than 84,000 miles of flowing waters. While we may not be ready for a gradient beyond that of a lazy river, even the calm and stillness of gentle streams can offer physical challenge, excitement, or adventure. Gently paddling through, you notice scenery, animals, and sounds that you typically would not. There is something about quietly flowing through water that makes you a part of the surroundings, not just a visitor. When I walk through instead, I feel I'm imposing my heavy footsteps, leaving my footprint trail and evidence of my presence. In the water, we can paddle closely up to turtles on a log, herons and cranes in a marsh, and even share a shallow stream with fish swimming alongside you. Family dynamics are a bit different too. I'm usually stuck sharing my kayak with my younger daughter. I know better than to think that she would help paddle. In fact, I don't even bother giving her a paddle. The most memorable quote from all our kayaking is made by that younger daughter of mine. "You do all the paddling, Mama. I'll enjoy the view." What's also interesting, and psychologists will attest to this, is that when you're not face-to-face with your child, sometimes they speak more freely with you. It's like having a deep conversation while going for a drive, magnified times 10 when you're together in a kayak out in nature. Kids speak more easily of their most recent dreams, tussles on the playground, or conversations with their best friend. They use parts of their brain that are oftentimes turned off during their long stints with their tablets and other electronics. They also connect with nature and process things like what impact we have on the environment when we litter, or why everyone passing by on the water seems to always be in a happy mood. The pace of the world is starting to pick up again. While the journey through a pandemic will have its ups and downs before we fully recover, my family and I plan to continue on our winding journey through the waters of Wisconsin, to slow things down a little and really take in how much Wisconsin has to offer.
Micey Vang of Sun Prairie brought us that story about paddling her way through the pandemic. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
I think I need that ambient water sound in my ears all the time. That's pretty nice. Coming up, we take a look at climate policy promises coming out of this week's Global Climate Summit. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, Renaissance festivals have been around since the 1960s, and their popularity has been growing ever since. But why are they so beloved, and who are they for? Huzzah! It's Ye Olde Ren Fair today at 6 on 1A+. Now, global leaders are meeting this week in Glasgow, Scotland for the COP26 Climate Summit. Some big promises have come out of the conference so far, including a pledge to cut methane emissions by a third by 2030 and a pledge to end deforestation the same year. Gregory Nemet is a professor at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. He's author of the book How Solar Energy Became Cheap, a model for low carbon innovation. Gregory, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, good, Rob. It's good to be here.
Before we get to some of the specifics out of this, how hard is it to get a whole bunch of countries to get together and agree and commit to a measurable change that's going to have an impact on climate change?
Well, I'll give you one answer to that is we've been working on it for more than 30 years and we're not quite there yet. So it's not because we haven't wanted to do something about it. It's not because we didn't know it's a big problem. It's because it's hard to get agreement on, you know, almost 200 countries representing almost 8 billion people with a lot of, you know, different preferences on what they want from their lives. And so what we need is cooperation, and that's been hard, but we are making progress.
Here we have this methane emission agreement, including European Union, the United States, ends up with about 100 countries plus actually saying we're going to cut methane emissions 30% by the year 2030. Can you explain the significance of that and the focus on methane?
Yeah, methane, which we often think of as natural gas, so that's what a lot of us use to cook with our stoves, that's a substantial amount of the greenhouse gases that we put into the atmosphere. So it's not the most. CO2 or carbon dioxide is the most common, but it's about 18%. But it's been one that has been growing quickly and harder to change than it has been for CO2. So to actually do something substantial with large participation, like you said, 100 countries, is a big deal. And, you know, it has the potential to have a bigger impact in the short term because methane doesn't last in the atmosphere as long as CO2 does. So it's pretty substantial and kind of a novel effort here. So it is kind of a breakthrough compared to some of the more incremental progress in other areas.
And as I'm hearing it from the Biden administration, Gregory, one of the ways the U.S. would hit that target is plugging leaks? One of our big methane sources is leaks from the natural gas supply system?
We drill a lot of holes. We have drilled a lot of holes over the last 100 years looking for oil, looking for natural gas. And once that oil is extracted, there's often gas with it. Or once the gas is extracted, we aren't as careful plugging it up as we are of making the hole in the beginning. And so, yeah, there's lots of leakage throughout the system. And a lot of it, as you say, is from abandoned or non-productive oil and gas wells, but there's other places too, like pipelines across the country. And then even the distribution systems that go to almost every one of our 100 million households in the U.S. has a natural gas line, and those leak all a little bit, and it adds up. And a little bit of leakage makes a big difference because methane is such a powerful greenhouse gas. So yeah, the oil and gas wells and these other parts of the leakages could make a big impact there. And the Biden administration thinks we can do something like 70% reduction just by being more careful, just by, you know, not thinking about natural gas as something that's not that valuable, that just goes away, and thinking about it actually does damage to us, to humanity, once it gets up into the atmosphere.
I've seen the phrase, before we move on from methane, the phrase low-hanging fruit used a few times in reference to this idea that, plugging leaks and things like that can make a measurable difference.
Right. It's not high technology. It's doing things just carefully in a lot of different places. But, you know, the upside of that is there's a lot of jobs that will be associated with doing that, with maintaining these lines and improving, getting rid of the leakage throughout the system. So there's a potential for economic opportunity in addition to the climate benefits.
Talking to Gregory Nemeth, professor at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs, looking at deals, agreements reached in this week's International Climate Summit in Scotland. A piece of news you've been following, I understand, Gregory, India pledged to hit net zero emissions by 2070. What a big country, a lot of people there. What's the significance of that commitment?
It's significant for the two things you said: big country, a lot of people, also growing quickly, also burns a lot of coal, and also did not have a commitment to reduce its emissions. And that's different from all the other big emitters like the US, the EU. Even China has a target for getting to net zero, for, in their case, 2060. So for India to actually come and say they're going to have a target was actually a surprise. And I think that reflects a lot of effort and diplomacy that's happened over the last 12 months. So that's a big deal. And just today, India itself could make the difference of maybe half a degree or maybe a little bit less than that of avoided warming. And so what India does makes a huge difference because they're about 20 years behind where China has been in terms of building infrastructure, modernizing, and becoming a big consumer of energy. And so if India decides to do that in a low carbon way with access to modern technologies like solar and wind and electric vehicles, that makes a big difference. So yeah, I'm glad you highlighted that one, because India getting to net zero by 2070 would make a big difference.
Is this a hard sell for the industrial world to make for still industrializing countries like India, who could say, hey, you guys got to use all the coal you wanted in your industrial revolution. We're trying to do that now. Why did you get to do that and we don't? Do people make that sort of justice argument?
They've been making that argument for quite a while. And I think what's happened, and this is really probably one of the reasons I'm most optimistic now compared to 5 or 10 years ago, is that's a weaker argument now. And it's weaker not because we don't care about developing countries developing and attaining the lifestyles that we have and going beyond that. But it's different because now there are alternatives to develop in a way that is low carbon, that doesn't have to deal with fossil fuels of oil and gas and coal. And it's about this dramatic cost reductions we've seen in solar power, in wind power, and increasing with batteries that help for wind and solar to work when it's not sunny and windy, but also allow us to use transportation, renewable energy for transportation. And those three technologies, wind, solar, batteries, and then digitalization that connects it all together, those were not affordable and would have, as you said, been kind of a sacrifice and a more expensive way to develop. But that's not true today. So now in a lot of countries, including developing countries, the cheapest way to make electricity is with solar, period. And so that starts to really change things. And I think India sees that as well. And then it also has these co-benefits. They're super important of health co-benefits that if you go to any of the large cities in India become immediately apparent. And so that's an even bigger near-term incentive to clean up their electricity and develop in a low carbon way, because they don't have to worry about things like air pollution of, you know, kids going to hospitals with asthma and bronchitis that we have in this country and increasingly happening in cities in the developing world too. And so you get that benefit in a local and near-term way, as well as the climate benefits.
I know it's easy to focus on ways that the world is falling short on climate change efforts, the still changing climate. What kind of positive developments, though, would you point us toward over the past, say, 5-10 years?
I'll say four. One I just talked about, technology, makes a huge difference. That's really opened up a lot of possibility. The second is that people are much more mobilized and aware of climate damages today. And some of that is for bad reasons, because the climate is getting worse. But some of it is for positive reasons, that we're seeing people care, people vote, people organize, and especially the youth. That has really become an international, connected, and highly mobilized group of people that are growing up, becoming more politically savvy, starting to run for office, definitely voting. And so that's another part. I think that we've had almost 90% of the world's emissions with the India development you mentioned now have committed to net zero. That wasn't true 5 years ago. And so, you know, there's a lot more to be said in terms of whether those commitments turn into real action and policy. But that's a big step, as we're actually talking about a zero carbon world in the next 30 to 40 years. And then the fourth thing I would say is there actually is evidence of countries implementing policies and reducing emissions. And some of the work I've been looking at shows that it's more than 24 countries have actually reduced their emissions over at least a 10-year period of time. And so there are models for this working, which don't involve a lot of sacrifice, don't involve compromise, and lead to a lot of increases in inclusive well-being that I think people will want to emulate. And with the technologies available today, there's a lot more examples for other cities and other countries to follow. So there are a lot of reasons to be optimistic, even though this is a daunting problem and we're behind and the climate is getting worse. But there are a lot of things going in the right direction.
And just in our last minute, I want to touch on another commitment. A lot of countries committed to ending deforestation by the year 2030. How significant do you see that?
There's a lot of carbon in forest. And some of the work that I and others do think about ways that we could have forests retain more carbon. But if we're cutting down forests to expand agriculture or to expand space for urban settlements, that's going in the wrong direction. That's taking carbon that's locked up in the trunks of trees and the roots of trees and putting into the atmosphere, either by letting the trees decay or burning them. And so that's exactly the opposite of what we want to do. And so to actually say we're going to end forest loss in this decade goes in the right direction. I think notably what's important here is who's involved. And it's countries that have some of the biggest forests in the world, like Russia, or some of the most important, like Brazil, and then another big actor, China. And they've all signed on to this ending deforestation by 2030. And so, like, all of the commitments at this Scotland meeting, you know, we'll see what happens in terms of real policies and how they're implemented and all the accounting and the verification. That will all matter. Mm-hmm. But the fact that these big countries have agreed to this is a step in the right direction.
Thanks to our guest, Gregory Nemeth from UW-Madison's La Follette School, looking at climate change commitments. Tomorrow on Central Time, a rise in cigarette sales. Why? What does it mean? That's tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then Republicans are celebrating an upset win in the Virginia governor's race. We'll talk about what that could mean for the 2022 midterm elections and for President Biden's economic agenda. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.